Okay, imagine for a second that you are a pilot. But you're not just any pilot, you're a test pilot, and the plane you're flying is the entire global economy.
That's a lot of pressure.
Right. And you want to know what happens if you pull back on the stick, say, you raise interest rates by 2%. Now, obviously, you can't just try it in real life to see if the wings fall off.
No, you definitely can't. Because
Yeah.
if you crash that plane, we all go down with it. You don't get a do-over with global GDP.
Exactly. So what you need is a flight simulator, a perfect digital copy of the machine. But here's the thing. The economy isn't a machine made of metal and hydraulics.
Not at all. It's made of millions of people making messy, sometimes irrational decisions every single day.
And that's exactly why, back in 1980, the Nobel laureate Robert Lucas he dropped this bombshell on the entire economics profession.
Oh, yeah. He basically said the days of solving economics with a pencil and a legal pad were over. He said our job description had fundamentally changed. We weren't just philosophers anymore.
Right. Our job was now to, and I'm quoting here, write a Fortran program that will accept specific economic policy rules as input and generate output statistics.
Which is a very academic way of saying the math got too hard for humans.
Let the robots handle.
Precisely. We move from what we call analytical solution, that's the stuff you can solve on a blackboard, to computational macroeconomics. And that is a huge, huge shift.
And that is exactly what we're going to unpack in this deep dive. We're looking under the hood of that flight simulator. We've pulled together a stack of technical notes and lecture materials to really decode the economist's toolkit.
We're going to see how you take this theoretical mess of human behavior and turn it into code that simulates our future.
And it's more than just code, isn't it? It's really a journey into how we make compromises.
It is. It's about how we trade off perfection for speed and how we teach a machine to understand or at least mimic human choice.
Speaking of compromises, let's start with the very first hurdle. It seems almost too simple to be a real problem, but computers are, well, kind of dumb.
Finite is the polite word. But yes, mathematically, they are limited. In economic theory, we love what we call continuous functions. Smooth curves, right? A supply curve that exists at every single microscopic price point.
But you can't store that in the computer.
You can't. To store a truly continuous line, you'd need infinite memory.
You can't just feed the idea of a curve into a hard drive. You have to digitize it somehow.
Exactly. Think of it like a digital photo. The real world has infinite resolution. A photo is just a grid of pixels. In economics, this is our first tool, approximation. How do we pixelate the economy?
The texts call this process interpolation, which sounds fancy, but it seems like it's just connecting the dots.
At its heart, it is. You pick a grid of specific points, say capital stock at 10 million, 20 million, 30 million, and you tell the computer the value at those exact dots. But the economy doesn't just live at those dots.
It lives in the spaces in between.
Right. So if you need to know what happens at 15 million, the computer has to guess.
Or estimate.
Estimate, yes. And the simplest way is linear interpolation. You just draw a straight line between the two nearest points.
Which seems safe. But maybe a little crude.
It's incredibly safe. It uses what we call local information, just its immediate neighbors. So it's
Ugh.
very robust. It rarely crashes the whole simulation, but it has a fatal flaw for economists.
Let me guess. The real world isn't made of straight lines.
Exactly. Economic functions are curvy, diminishing returns, utility. They're all curves. And if you approximate a curve with a bunch of straight lines, you get these jagged edges where they connect.
Like a saw blade. And in calculus, jagged
I'm not differentiable.
meaning you can't find the slope.
Right. And if you can't find a slope, a huge chunk of economic math just falls apart. You can't find the top of the hill if the hill is all jagged.
So we need a smoother way to connect the dots. The materials mention something called a cubic spline.
Right. So instead of a rigid ruler, imagine using a flexible one that can bend. A cubic spline uses these little curved cubic equations to connect the dots, but it forces them to line up perfectly at the seams, not just touching, but having the exact same slope.
So it looks like one continuous flowing ribbon.
Yes, it's beautiful and it's differentiable, but there's always a catch. To get that perfect smoothness, the math has to use global information.
Global. So what happens way over on the left side of the graph affects what's happening on the right.
Exactly. If you have one wheeled data point, an outlier, way over at zero, the spline might ripple that distortion all the way across the graph just to maintain that smoothness.
Nah. So it's like pulling a loose thread on a sweater. The whole thing bunches up.
That's a perfect analogy. And that's the trade-off. Linear is jagged but stable. Splines are smooth but fragile.
Okay, now there's a third method here that feels totally different, the known functions approach, using Chebyshev polynomials. This sounded to me a lot like running a regression.
It's very similar in spirit. Yeah. Instead of a grid of dots, you assume the economic function is like a recipe made from standard ingredients, these polynomials. You just tell the computer, find the best weighted combination of these shapes to mimic my curve.
So you're not storing points, you're just storing the recipe.
Exactly. It's very elegant, very memory efficient, but again, it's a global method. So you always have to choose your weapon, jagged stability or smooth fragility.
Okay, so we've taught the computer what the economy looks like. We've drawn the curves. But economics isn't just staring at pictures. We need to find an answer,
And
equilibrium.
which brings us to part two, root finding, which in math terms just means we're trying to solve for when Oracles is dollars or dollars.
I have to admit, this is something I struggled with at first in the reading. Why is finding zeros so important? Why not find 5 or 10?
Well, think about something like excess demand. That's just demand minus supply.
Right.
When that equation equals zero,
The market clears.
the market clears. The price is right. Finding an equilibrium is literally just finding the zero point of a function.
Got it. Okay, so zero is the sweet spot. And to find that spot, the texts lay out a race between the tortoise and the hare.
I love this comparison. The tortoise is the bisection method. It is the absolute definition of slow and steady.
This is the brute force guessing game.
We call it bracketing. Let's say you know the market clears somewhere between a price of $10 and $100. You check the math. At $10, demand is huge. It's positive. At $100, demand is negative. So the answer must be in between.
So you check the midpoint, $55.
Exactly. And if demand at $55 is still positive, you throw away the whole bottom half. Now you just look between $55 and $100. You just keep cutting the interval in half over and over.
It sounds painfully slow.
It is slow, but it's bulletproof. If your function is continuous, bisection will find the answer. It cannot fail. And you know exactly how long it's going to take.
Okay, but we live in a world of high-frequency trading. We can't wait all day. So enter the hare, Newton Raphson.
The speed demon. Newton Raphson doesn't just guess intervals. It looks at the ground it's standing on. It calculates the slope, the derivative.
So it stands at a price of $10, looks at the slope of the curve, and says, "Whoa, it's really steep here. The zero must be way over there."
Roughly, yeah. It shoots a tangent line down to the zero axis and just jumps to that spot. If the function is well behaved, if it's nearly linear, Newton Raphson is magic. It converges quadratically,
You mean?
meaning every step you take doubles the number of accurate digits. You get the answer in just a few steps.
But like the fable, I'm guessing the hare can get distracted.
Oh, absolutely. If the curve is wild, if it has weird humps or flat spots, Newton's method can shoot you off into infinity. It can just diverge completely. You need a good starting guess and you need a smooth function.
So bisection is the reliable pickup truck that always gets there eventually.
And Newton is the Formula One car that might just explode if you hit a bump.
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. And this connects directly to the next big tool, optimization.
Right, because we're not just finding prices, we're maximizing things, utility, profits, welfare, yeah. And this is where we get the coolest dinner party fact from the materials. One of the best ways to maximize something uses what? Greek architecture?
The golden section search. It's fascinating. It's a search algorithm to find the peak of a hill. But instead of cutting the search area in half, like bisection, it cuts it by the golden ratio, about 0.618.
And it's not because the computer is an art critic. It's purely about efficiency. It turns out if you use the golden ratio to place your test points, you can recycle one of your calculations for the next step. It's mathematically the most efficient way to shrink a search without needing derivatives.
But the big aha moment for me in the text was that optimization and root finding, they're basically the same problem.
They're twins separated at birth. Yeah, think about it. When you're climbing a hill and you reach the absolute peak, what's the slope of the ground under your feet?
It's flat, zero.
Exactly. So maximizing a function, let's call it phi dox, is literally just finding the root of its derivative. If you can find zero, you can find a maximum. All those tools, Newton, bisection, they all apply here too.
Okay, so we can draw the economy, we can solve the economy. But the real world has this nasty habit of surprising us. Shocks, a sudden tech boom, a pandemic.
Uncertainty. This brings us to part three, discretization.
And this goes back to the computer memory problem again, doesn't it?
Mm.
Real life risks are continuous. My income might go up by 1.2% or 1.25 or 1.259.
Right. It's usually some bell curve of possibilities, but the computer wants a list. It wants a Markov chain, a nice, clean grid of specific scenarios with specific probabilities of moving between them.
The text highlights two heavy hitters here, Tauken and Ruhenhorst. They sound like rival detective agencies.
They sort of are. Tauken is the classic. It just takes the area under the bell curve and chops it up into blocks. It works great for standard shocks where things aren't too connected to the past.
But what if they are connected?
That's persistence. In economics, shocks tend to stick around. We call it rho. If rho is close to one, it means if you lose your job today, you probably won't have one tomorrow either. The shock persists.
And that's where Tauken struggles.
Yeah, when shocks are highly persistent, Tauken's method gets inaccurate. It doesn't capture the variance well, and that's when you call the other agency.
Ruhenhorst.
It's designed specifically for high persistence. It guarantees that the mean and variance of your blocky computer grid will match the real continuous world exactly. So if you're modeling something sticky, like income or productivity, you ignore Ruhenhorst at your own peril.
Okay. We have curves, we have solvers, we have our little buckets of risk. Now, we have to eat the cake.
Ah, yes. Part four, dynamic programming. This is the heart and soul of modern macroeconomics.
The example in the notes is literally called the cake eating problem.
Yeah.
And honestly, it sounds stressful. You have a cake. You have infinite time. How much do you eat today?
It perfectly captures the fundamental human dilemma, right?
Yeah.
Consumption versus savings. If I eat a huge slice today, I'm happy now, but I have less capital or cake for tomorrow. And since tomorrow goes on forever, that's a big problem.
So how on earth does a computer solve a problem that lasts forever? It can't count to infinity.
It uses a brilliant trick called the Bellman equation. It breaks the infinite problem into just two manageable periods, today and the future.
But if we don't know the value of the future yet.
No, we don't. So we guess. This is value function iteration, or VFI. The computer starts by guessing, I think the value of leftover cake is zero.
Which is a terrible guess.
Terrible. But it plugs that guess into the equation, solves for the best decision today, and that gives it a new value function. Then it takes that new function, plugs it back in as the future, and does it all over again.
Rinse and repeat.
Exactly. And here is the single most comforting concept in all of economics, the contraction mapping theorem.
It sounds like a sci-fi weapon.
It's a mathematical guarantee. It says that no matter how stupid your first guess is, you could guess the value of cake is purple, if you just keep iterating, the algorithm will shrink the error. It will converge to the one true answer. It's the holy grail of reliability.
So why don't we just use VFI for everything? It's robust. It's guaranteed to work. What's the catch?
The catch is the curse of dimensionality.
Sounds ominous.
It is. VFI is slow. Really slow. If you have one variable cake, it's easy. But now add labor. Add inflation, add foreign exchange. For every single variable you add, the grid of points you need to calculate grows exponentially.
So a complex model of the global economy would take a million years to solve.
Or more. Even our biggest supercomputers choke on global VFI when the dimensions get high. You just run out of computing power.
So we need a shortcut. A cheat code. And that brings us to the final tool, linearization.
This is what most working economists use day to day. VFI is a global method. It solves for every possible state of the world, from a huge crash to a massive boom. Linearization is a local method.
It's the difference between having a map of the entire planet versus just a subway map of your neighborhood.
Perfect analogy. We assume the economy mostly hangs around a steady state, a sort of resting point. We assume shocks are small. And if you zoom in close enough to any curve, what does it start to look like?
A straight line.
Exactly. So if we treat the economy as a system of linear equations, we can use simple matrix algebra. We don't need to iterate a million times. We can solve it in a split second.
And there's this concept mentioned called certainty equivalence, which sounds like a superpower.
It kind of is. In a linear world, you don't need to worry about the full range of crazy risks. You can just act as if future variables will be exactly their average value. The decision rule is the same whether a disaster happens or nothing happens.
That simplifies things massively.
Yeah.
But surely there's a danger in assuming the world is a straight line.
A huge danger. Linear models, they like to explode.
Explode how?
Mathematically. Because you're just approximating, variables can start compounding on each other and just fly off to infinity.
So how do we stop the model from predicting that GDP becomes infinite next Tuesday?
We check the Blanchard-Kahn condition. This is the safety valve.
Okay, I want to get this right because the text got a bit heavy here. It's about balancing eigenvalues and jump variables.
Think of it like this. You're balancing a broom on your hand. Gravity wants to pull the broom down, That's an explosive eigenvalue. It wants to fall. To keep it upright, you have to constantly move your hand.
That's the jump variable.
That's your jump variable, things like stock prices or consumption that can change instantly. The Blanchard-Kahn condition basically asks, do you have exactly enough jump variables to counteract all the explosive forces? If the numbers match, one broom, one hand, you have a stable, unique equilibrium. You're on the saddle path.
And if they don't match?
Then your model is junk. It's either indeterminate, meaning anything could happen, or it's explosive, meaning it just predicts nonsense. When you run software like Dynera, which is the industry standard, this is the very first thing it checks. If Blanchard-Kahn fails, the computer just spits the model right back at you.
Wow. We have covered a lot of ground. We went from pixelating curves to hunting for zeros to the agony of the cake problem, and finally to the linear shortcut that keeps the whole thing running fast.
It really is a journey from the simple to the complex, and then kind of back to the simple, but for the sake of actually getting things done.
And I think it's important to remind you, listening, most of this math is hidden now, right? You mentioned Dynera.
Oh, yes. The software does all the heavy lifting. But, and this is why we did this deep dive, you cannot treat the computer like a black box.
Because when the red light starts flashing,
you need to know why. If your simulation looks jagged, you need to know your interpolation grid is too coarse. If your model explodes, you need to understand why the Blanchard-Kahn condition failed. Is your economic theory wrong, or is it just your math?
It's the difference between a mechanic who just swaps parts and one who actually understands internal combustion.
Exactly.
So here's my final thought, something for you to chew on. We spend all this time building these linear local approximations because they're fast. We assume the world is always near its steady state.
And it works great for small shocks, you know, a tax hike, a little productivity bump.
But we live in a world of financial crises, global pandemics, massive structural shifts. Those aren't small shocks. They're non-linear beasts.
That is the ultimate trade-off.
So are our linear tools blinding us? If we rely on certainty equivalence, are we fundamentally incapable of predicting the big crashes that actually matter? Or is the perfect answer, the global solution, just too expensive computationally to even bother with?
That is the billion-dollar question. Maybe the next generation of economists and quantum computers will solve that one for us.
Until then, keep your pencils sharp, but maybe keep your processors running cooler. Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive.